Additional Encore audio archive recordings are available at www.12steptapes.com. We request you not upload this recording to the major free outlets. We are happy to allow free listening on our own site with a subscription service. Contact us on www.12steptapes.com for more information.
You and me need to be friends. Yeah? All right. Hi, my name's Quincy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Quincy.
I am so happy to be here, and thank you so much for asking me. I want to thank the committee for having me. It is an honor and a privilege to do this, to be asked to do this. I am super grateful to be here, so thank you for that. Billy and Sherry and Doug and the ladies for taking me to dinner tonight. We had a nice time, and, you know, it's just so sweet up here. Like, it's just such a cute little town, and we used to come here when I was... And I have nothing but drunk, naked memories of 5 minutes in this town, but I got a lot of nakedness going on over there. I also want to thank you for driving me 270 miles to come be with y'all. So my best friend, we got married a year ago. We just celebrated a year of, I almost said sobriety, but of marriage last weekend. So I'm happy to get to be here with him. So I'll give you some important information so you can judge me properly. My sobriety date is February 1st, 1988. Reagan was president. That's how long ago that was. I have a home group. And I have a sponsor, and she knows she's my sponsor, and she has a sponsor, and I'm super grateful for the legacy of sponsorship. You know, I wasn't always. I didn't come here wanting a sponsor by any stretch of the imagination, and I didn't want a home group either. You know, today my home group is the Principles Before Personalities Big Book Study in Sherman Oaks, California, on Thursday nights at 7:30. And you know, and the reason I did not want a home group, because the truth was that if you knew me, you wouldn't like me, and this way I don't like you first, so we're even. And that was the thinking that I really came into Alcoholics Anonymous with, right? Like, I really believed that this was just about drugs and alcohol, and if I could just get rid of the drugs and the alcohol, I'd be fine, right? And everything would be okay, and I could skip to my loo some day and never come back, right? And I was 18 years old when I got sober. And I wasn't trying to get sober. I didn't really even want to be sober. I was telling them yesterday that I came in through the doors of Alateen and Al-Anon, which I'll get into. And, you know, it's amazing how any of us get here sometimes. You know, I wonder, you know, all the planets have to align. Welcome to our newcomer. You know, all the planets have to align for us to be here and to stay. And you know, that's not always the case. So I'm a big fan of interviewing my audience, just because if I'm going to get up here and reveal myself, I'd like a little revealing from you too, right? I shouldn't be the only one that gets naked here. I'm just saying, okay? You mind playing along with me? All right. So how many of you, this is your first time getting sober? This sobriety date is your first and only sobriety date. That's pretty good, right? How many of you started drinking in your teens? Well done. How many of you blacked out? Well done. How many of you woke up naked in strange places? Oh, well done. How many of you woke up naked in strange places with strange people? Well done. How many of you went to jail? Well done. How many of you know somebody who's died from this disease? How many of you know somebody who's died from this disease this year? Yeah. How many of you have drugs as part of your story? How many of you are pure alcoholics? Wow. Wow. Yeah. It's still a thing. How many of you have a sponsor? How many of you sponsor? How many of you have read the big book? They love it when it's not everybody, because I was in that group for a long time. How many of you, I forgot the next question. Oh, how many of you met the love of your life in Alcoholics Anonymous? This year. Yeah, which time? Right? Which year? How many of you stayed out of a relationship in your first year? Yeah, like four of you. That's great. How many of you go to more than three meetings a week? Awesome. There's so much long-term sobriety up here. It's really cool. How many of you are excited about being in Alcoholics Anonymous? How many of you feel like it's very different since COVID? Have felt the difference, right? All right. So I like to do that because I just like to see who I'm hanging out with, right? Because, I mean, we're all alcoholics, but we don't all party the same way, right? So I got to make sure that, you know, we're all partying the same way, but we did. And so I'll just tell you about me. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley. Doesn't make me an alcoholic, but it helped. And my dad was in the music business. He designed album covers. Most of you are old enough to remember what album covers are, so I don't have to explain that, which is fantastic. But he designed album covers, and, you know, so we had a lot of really interesting, cool, funny kind of people that hung out at our house all of the time. And I didn't know that what was happening at my house wasn't normal. I thought everybody had drunk, naked musicians running around their house. I didn't know that you didn't. Are you saying you did too? Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, how many people had drunk, naked musicians running around their house? Oh, well done. So anyway, so that was just the house that I grew up in. My dad was an alcoholic, but he was the kind of alcoholic who was a lot of fun. Like, he wanted to have a good time all the time. He wasn't angry. He wasn't violent. He didn't sexually molest us. He was sexually inappropriate verbally often, but he never molested us. We didn't get in trouble that way. And from what I remembered of my childhood, I had a great childhood. I didn't know that what was happening in my house wasn't normal. And, you know, I don't remember my first drink. When you grow up in an alcoholic home, there's alcohol everywhere. And so, or in my house there was. And I mean, one of our chores on the weekend was to take my dad's beer cans from the weekend or the week that he did, and we would line them up down the driveway and take sledgehammers and race to smash them so we could take them to the recycler. Like, that's what alcoholic children do, right? Like, you grow up in an alcoholic home, beer smashing cans is a chore. And that was just what it was like at my house. You know, I remember my first drunk, though, and I remember it like it was yesterday. And, you know, I remember very distinctly who I was before that night and who I was after that night, right? And the kid that I was before that night was this kid who... I was the oldest of three children. I was taller than everybody else. I had bigger boobs than everybody else, right? Eventually that changed and they never grew again, and that was not the thing. But you know, I was awkward and I was uncomfortable, and I didn't know that that's what I was. What I also was I was obsessed with what you were thinking about me. Was I funny enough? Was I cute enough? Did you like me? Did my butt look cute in these jeans? Did I like the right bands? You know, did I swear right? Like, I was so worried about what you thought of me and whether or not I was likable that was my entire focus for a long time. And that focus made me very anxious, right? Made me very anxious, made me very uncomfortable, and I had absolutely no idea that any of that was any kind of normal or what to do with any of those feelings, right? And when I was 12-ish, 12 and a half-ish, I have a cousin who's 8 years older than me, and she was graduating from high school, and she invited me to a party at her house. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I'm so excited. I get to go hang out with all the big kids, and, you know, this is going to be cool. But oh my, I'm like the little kid. They're going to treat me like a little kid. This is going to be weird. How's this going to go? Like, again, one more time, I was stressed out and worried about how this was going to go. And I can remember walking up the walk to their house and just being on fire in my head about what was going to happen and how it was going to go and not feeling comfortable. And I walked in and they were sitting around card tables like that one, right, playing quarters, right? Now I'm 12 years old. I've never played quarters in my entire life, okay? But one of the greatest attributes of being an alcoholic is I can walk into any situation and adapt like that, right? And so I walk in and I sat down at that card table and I acted like I'd been playing quarters all 12 years of my life, right? And it was great, you know? And we started to drink and I started to feel the alcohol go into my system. And all of a sudden, I started to notice the magic, right? And the magic of alcohol for me was that whatever I was feeling, whatever I was thinking, would easily disappear with a few drinks, right? And for the first time in my life, everything that was going on between my ears was gone, and it was quiet. And that was magic for me. You know, I was somebody who was so toxically insecure that I could not relax, right? And alcohol made that disappear in a matter of minutes, and it was magic for me. You know, did I become a daily drinker at 12 years old? Absolutely not. But did I become obsessed from that point forward with what do I have to do and where do I have to go and who do I have to be in order to make that happen again? Absolutely, right? I went from being this kid who was pretty decent in school, who was obsessed with being a prima ballerina, who was, you know, doing, you know, a normal childhood, to all of a sudden being this kid who took a hard right turn and was starting to live a double life. Like, I would go to school, I would come home, do my homework, I would have dinner with my family, I would go to bed at like 7:30, 8 o'clock, which should have been their first sign that something was wrong. I would wait for my family to go to bed, and then I would slip out my window and take a cab from Encino to Hollywood or Encino to Sherman Oaks at 13, 14 years old to go clubbing with all my friends, right? And that was magic. Like, I was having the time of my life, right? And I had felt like, it talks about in the Big Book, like I had arrived, right? All of a sudden, things were exciting. I was meeting new and interesting people and going to new and interesting places. And there were boys, and there was dancing, and there was drugs and alcohol. And it was just a party, and I was so excited. And then I'd get home at like 4 o'clock in the morning, sleep for a couple hours, and go to school. And I did this all the time, right? Right as this was starting to happen, right, my father's alcoholism took a huge nosedive, as it does, right, and he ended up in rehab in 1981. Now, in 1981, in the music business, it was super, super, super not cool to be an alcoholic, right? Today, if you're in the music business and you go to rehab, you leave with a record deal. Like, it's a whole different deal, right? But back then, you would get totally blackballed from society. And my dad ended up in St. John's. He ended up in rehab. And my mom became myopically focused on trying to get him sober, and that was all she could think about, right? So the three of us, I was the oldest of three, it didn't even matter what we did. She didn't have time to pay attention. And so she's chasing him in and out of rehab and in and out of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God we have Al-Anons here, or, you know, we'd all be in trouble. But they finally got a hold of her, because that's what they do, and they said, you know, we have meetings for the wives of alcoholics. It's called Al-Anon. And she said, okay, great. And so she started going to meetings, and then she learned that they had meetings for the kids. She said, you know, you can bring your kids to meetings. They're called Alateen, and they can learn about alcoholism and, you know, share about what's going on and blah, blah, blah. And I remember my mom coming home and saying to me, like, oh, my God, you're going to love this. They have meetings for kids your age where you can come and talk about alcoholism and learn about it and, you know, make friends. And I'm looking at her like she's a cyclops. I'm like, there's no way in the world I'm going to this stupid meeting. I would rather poke myself in the eye with a hot poker than go to this meeting. And she's like, no, you got to go. You got to go. I think you're going to love it. And I just remember thinking, oh, God, like, I would rather do anything than this, right? Well, my life is fine. I don't care what's going on with you people. And I just remember thinking, if I have to go to this stupid meeting, I'll just get as stoned as I can possibly stand. And that way I'm not really there, right? So I got as stoned as I can stand, and I got in the back of my mom's car, and she drove over the hill to Brentwood. And as we're driving there, I'm making plans, right? Like we do, right? Like, I'm not going to this stupid meeting, right? Like, I'll go for a walk, right? I'll go sit in a bush, right? I'll go rob a liquor store, but I am not going to this stupid meeting, right? And she pulls up in front of the church, and I look out the window, and there's all these kids hanging out that are roughly the same age as me, right? And I saw the most beautiful boy I have ever seen in my entire life. And I got out of that car so fast, and I went to Alateen religiously for the next 7 years, right? Because this is a program of attraction rather than promotion, right? We don't really care what attracts you, just stay. Right? And I did. It was great, right? We would go, we would sit in these meetings, and we would talk about what a hot mess our parents were and all the crazy stuff that was going on in our house. And then we would go try it. Many, many nights, my mom picked me up from Alateen, hammered out of my mind. And it was just a different time. Like, that was just what was going on. And, you know, I made so many friends and got to go to so many places similar to this. Like, we were talking about conventions earlier, and we used to go to the SoCal convention when there was like 8 and 10,000 people at the SoCal convention and the San Fernando Valley convention that had a whole bunch of people. And I became, you know, super active in Alateen. I was chairperson of the San Fernando Valley part for the Alateens and all that kind of stuff. And it was great. And my mom saw absolutely nothing wrong. Nothing wrong with putting her 13-year-old daughter on a train in Los Angeles, sending her to San Diego to go spend the weekend with her friends with a couple $100 in her pocket at an AA convention. She saw nothing wrong with that. She's like, well, you're with the AAs, you'll be fine, it's Alateen, how bad could it be, right? So the fact that I ended up drunk, butt naked, covered in shaving cream at an AA convention should not shock any of you, right? Because that's what I did, right? Like, I like to say all the time, there's no such thing as social drinking at 13. That's not a thing. Right? I started drinking from the very moment I started drinking for the effect. And more effect, the better. Right? What does social drinking look like? I don't even know what that means, right? I would hear that in meetings and I'd go, what are they talking about? Like, I don't know what they're talking about, right? Because we didn't do that. Like, you had to drink fast. Your mom was coming. Like, you got to get down and move on, you know? And so every time I drank, every time I got the opportunity to drink, things happened, right? Because I'm the kind of person who consequences happen quickly for, right? And I started to black out pretty quickly, right? And I started to wake up naked in strange places, right? One of my friends who I've known since I was 12 years old, like, we met because I came to naked underneath a glass coffee table in his house after a party. That was how we met, and we're good friends now. And that was just what was happening for me. And at 13 and 14 and 15 years old, that's not normal behavior. Right? Just so we're clear, that's not normal behavior for a 40-year-old either, okay? In case anybody... That's definitely not normal behavior for a 15-year-old, right? And because I had been around the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had come to love hearing the stories of Alcoholics Anonymous, like, I love listening to speakers, right? I loved Caitlin today, I loved George last night, I'm looking forward to you tomorrow. Like, I love the stories of Alcoholics Anonymous. I could listen to AA stories all day long, right? And I did. I fell madly in love with the people in Alcoholics Anonymous because I understood the stories. I felt the stories, right, from the very beginning. But for a long time, I did not know what it meant to be an alcoholic. I thought that being an alcoholic was based on your consequences, right? I'll never forget going to a meeting and hearing this guy share about being so drunk he tried to steal a battleship, right? And I thought, well, I've never tried to steal a battleship, so I must not be an alcoholic, right? And then I'd go back the next week, and some woman would be up there talking about she was so drunk, and she came to in her best friend's husband's bed, right? And I was like, oh, I relate to her. So this week I'm an alcoholic, right? And so I didn't understand what alcoholism was about. I didn't understand that alcoholism isn't based on consequences, that consequences are our flags to tell us that there's a problem, right? But I really thought that because my consequences were similar to what was going on with you, I knew that something was wrong. Because what was happening to me wasn't happening to the people I was drinking with and the people I was hanging out with in high school. Like, that was not happening to them. But it was happening to me, and it happened every time, right? So I got sober the first time at 15 and a half years old. And I would go to meetings in Orange County, right, because I didn't want to run into anybody who might possibly know me in Los Angeles, right? So I would spend all of my weekends with all my Alateen and AA friends in Orange County, going to meetings, doing the deal, and then I would come home during the week and be, you know, Quincy of Encino, right? And the thing that was great about that was, I don't know about you, but when I stopped having drugs and alcohol in my life, right, all that toxic insecurity, all that anxiety, all of that, you know, just painful angst of being me came rushing back to the surface, and all of a sudden my character defects are running wild and running the show, right? And I'm obsessed one more time with what you're thinking about me and what do I have to do and where do I have to go and who likes me, who doesn't like me, what do I have to say? And so I would go to Orange County on the weekends and I'd be Quincy of Orange County, and then I'd come home during the week and be Quincy of Encino, and they were not the same person, right? Because y'all had different requirements down there in Orange County than you had in Encino. So I would just fit myself into whatever situation I had to fit into so that I could be okay, right? And that's a survival technique of growing up in an alcoholic home, right? That's how I learned to survive, was to adapt to the environment I'm in, right? And this was no different. But what ends up happening for somebody like me is that because I don't have any tools and because I have no relief from that toxic insecurity, that overwhelming anxiety, and that unbridled emotional immaturity, eventually it becomes really, really necessary to pick up a drink, right? Really necessary, right? In order to live, right? And, you know, so I'm going to meetings. I stayed sober for almost 2 years. And I would stand in the back, like our friend Doug back there. I'd stand in the back, and I would stand in the doorway, and I would judge y'all, right? I would stand there, and I would listen to what you were saying, and I would love the stories, but I'm like, ah, that doesn't apply to me. Oh, that doesn't mean anything, you know? And people would say, you know, that you guys would start talking about God, and I'd be like, oh, please, don't talk about God. Like, every hair on my body would stand up, because I was like, I can't deal with it, right? But what happened was, is that eventually I copped a resentment at somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous, because how hard is it to do that? And and I built a case, right? Any case builders? Anybody a case builder? Oh, you, thank God for the three of you being honest. Like, the rest of you are all liars, just so we're clear. But I'm a case builder, right? And what I mean by a case builder, right, is that I am a magician, right, at building a case about why I'm right about how wrong you are, right? And then I stack evidence to build confirmation bias, but I stack evidence to confirm that belief, and then I try to see how many people I can get on my team, right? That's the gossip part of it, right? Like, you did me wrong, but we're gonna go talk about Mary. And you know what Mary did? Mary did this, and Mary did that. And then I've got her standing next to me going, yeah, screw that Mary lady, you know, right? And now I've got a whole team, and I got a whole case of legal briefs, right? And I use that to build a case to justify leaving Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Because y'all are crazy, right? Y'all are drama queens and gossip mongers, and I am too, but we're not talking about me. We are talking about you. And all of a sudden, I was done, right? I was like, alcoholic. I mean, I was 18 years old at this point, right? Never had a legal drink. I can't possibly really be an alcoholic. It was just a phase, right? And I'm gone, right? And I'm out, and 20 minutes after making that decision, I was out and off to the races one more time. And, you know, and alcoholism is progressive, right? I didn't pick up where I left off. I picked up where I was, right? And anybody who's in here, right, how many of y'all have been sober more than once? Okay, thank you. So you all know how hard it is to get drunk when you have all those happy, shiny AA people in your head going, keep coming back, just pick up the phone, call your sponsor, blah, blah. Like, you got to get all them drunk in there too, right? Like, oh, God, you got to get them all drunk. And that's exhausting, right? So, like, I had to drink three times more than I had to before because you guys are loud, right? You got in there and you're loud. And I don't want to hear it, right? So I went from blacking out here and there once in a while to almost blacking out for the entire 6 months I was out there. Because that's what progression looks like in me, right? And I'm sure I demoralized myself incomprehensibly daily, probably. I have no idea because I don't really remember and I don't want to remember. The moments that I do remember of that time are super, super painful times for me. Super painful. And I'll just share the last one. My last drunk was on January 31st of 1988. And I was having a party. I was having a party for a girl I couldn't stand, right? Only because any reason to have a party is a reason to party. What do I care if I like her or not? Everybody, come over, right? And so everybody came over, and I apparently I was quite distraught because the boy that I was in love with, who had broken up with me and never wanted to see me again, thought I was an obnoxious cow, which I probably was, but he doesn't need to say that. And so I had started drinking way before everybody came over, obviously. And I don't remember, but I have been told stories that people were chasing me around the house all night, like hiding bottles from me, right? And putting bottles in places that they were thinking I wouldn't find them. After all, it is my house. I'm going to find them, okay? And so I have one moment that I came to where I was standing there holding a birthday cake, and we had just sung this girl, Happy Birthday. And then I proceeded to tell her in front of all of our friends exactly what I thought of her, right? That's one of the best skills we get here. Inventory taking, right? Of yours, not mine. I can take yours all day long, right? But I did this to this girl in front of all her friends, and she was horrified, right? And then I was out again. And then the next thing I came to was I was in my mom was out of town for the weekend, but somebody had put me to bed in her room, and I was beyond plastered. And some guy had come into the room and had gotten in bed with me and started to have his way with me, and I was so hammered I couldn't do anything about it. I was paralyzed. I couldn't talk. I couldn't move. And he did whatever he did, you know? And that wasn't the first time that happened, right? I know it wasn't the first time that happened. So the fact that I was one more time sexually assaulted in my own home and could not defend myself, that's a problem, right? But I just blacked out. I came in, I came out, and that was all I remember. And when I woke up on February 1st of 1988, I woke up mad. I woke up mad at God, mad at the world, mad at everybody on the planet, because I don't know about you, but I didn't want to be here. I didn't ask to be born, right? I didn't ask to be here. I don't want to be here. I'm too chicken to kill myself, but I don't want to be here. I don't know how to live in this thoughts with this, you know, all these ideas and function. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to talk to you. I don't know how to communicate. I don't know how to resolve a problem. I'm a hot mess, and I don't know how to be here, and I just would rather be dead, right? But I said a prayer that morning that I believe every alcoholic says at one point or another, and I didn't even remember that I had said it until I was like 6 years sober, but I did say, help me. Now, I don't know who I said help me to, right? I didn't grow up in a religious family, right? My father was an alcoholic, so he was atheist at best, right? My mother was a fallaway Southern Baptist who I just found out like 10 years ago doesn't believe in God but has been trying to get me to go to church my whole life. And I don't understand that whole scenario. But you know, I remember when I was 5 saying to my dad, who's God? And he said he was. That was the end of my religious upbringing, okay? That was it, right? Like, that was it. So I had no understanding of what a higher power was or any of that stuff. And so the fact that I said that out loud to the universe at all was, you know, it was bigger than me, because that's just not who I am, you know. I went and detoxed in my room for a couple of days, and my mom, being the beautiful, wonderful Al-Anon that she is, finally kicked the door down and said, you need to go to a meeting. And I remember thinking, oh God, no. Not those people, not again, right? Like, I can't do it, right? But I love you. I love you. I would love to be able to take off this dress, too. Jesus.
Not the same sentence.
Anyway, I might be 5 pounds lighter by the time I sit down, so that could be a good thing. Anyway, I couldn't stand my own company, right? So I finally put on my best outfit and went to a meeting. And somehow y'all knew I was new, right? Not sure if it was the bikini top or the Daisy Dukes or the candies I was wearing, but you all knew I was new, and you were super, super nice to me, right? And you'd come up and you'd give me cigarettes and you'd be like, hey, Quincy, it's great to see you. And nobody was happy to see me for years, like, at this point. So the fact that anybody, number one, remembered my name, or number two, was happy to see me was earth-shattering for me at the time. And that was why, like, in COVID, it was so weird in the beginning, right? It was so weird in the beginning because we didn't know how to get each other. We'd all get on Zoom and just kind of stare at each other, right? And then meetings started to figure out that we needed to have, you know, greeters on the meetings, right? And so people would start greeting, and they would start, you know, welcoming people to the meeting through Zoom, right? Because I have to tell you, it is so important, especially for alcoholics, for us to be seen. Right? We need to be seen. We need to be seen. But if I don't think you're watching, I will get away with everything. Right? Just because I can. Right? But if I walk into a room and you notice that I'm there, all of a sudden I'm going to act better. I feel like I'm a part of, because somebody remembered my name. Right? And it means the world, you know? And so, like, when I go to meetings and I see people welcoming people, I just know that I'm in the right place. Right? I know that I'm in the right place because we need to be seen, you know? They were super nice to me, and I was really lucky when I got sober that I landed in a group of people who were roughly the same age as me, right? Actually, my husband was in that group. He was not my husband then. We did not like each other. We had very strong opinions about each other, but we were all friends with the same people, right? And I was lucky because they would hold on to me and they would just drag me from meeting to meeting to meeting, to event to event to event, to convention to convention to convention, right? Like I was, all of a sudden I was super busy, right? And they would just drag us around. So if you are new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I hope that you're in a group of people that are just dragging you around, right? You're in WIPA, so I already know you are. So, you know, but that's what this is about. Because the truth of the matter is, right, is that between the time we get here and get sober and the time this ANA stuff kicks in, it could be a minute, right? It could be a minute. Because the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, they're a conflict resolution system, right? But because they're a conflict resolution system, it means that I will go to it when I have conflict, but not until I have conflict, right? We don't get anywhere without pain, right? When I get in enough pain, then all of a sudden I will be willing to do something differently, right? Or do something somebody else's way, but not a second before. Not 1 second before, right? And so there was a lot of years for me that I spent in Alcoholics Anonymous doing Alcoholics Anonymous my way, right? Because I didn't understand how this whole thing worked. I really believed that I was doing the deal. I thought because I was going to meetings, because I made friends, because I had a commitment that, you know, made me look cute, right? Like I was the chip girl. It's like, hi, you know, got me a lot of attention, right? You know, or I would talk to a newcomer if they were cute enough, whatever, you know what I mean? Like I thought I was doing the deal only to find out that I was just kind of doing the deal, right? The house I grew up in, my father was ridiculously smart, and he had, because he was an alcoholic, which I totally understand, he had zero tolerance for questions. Like, he wanted you to come already knowing the answer. Like, don't ask me a question, and don't ask me more than once, right? And so I grew up in a house where it wasn't okay to ask questions, right? So when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had that same thing going on. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous not wanting to look bad, not wanting to inconvenience anybody, not wanting to... for you to think I'm stupid, right, by asking a whole lot of questions. I just watched what you did, right, and then mimicked what you did, right? Which is super dangerous, by the way, because if you happen to end up in a that's not necessarily doing things in a very sober way, and you're just doing that, you end up doing what they're doing, right? And, you know, you can only be as good as the teacher that you had, right? And I ended up in a it was a great group, but it was a young group, right? And there was a bunch of old timers, and they were great. They were fantastic people. God, I love the old timers. I think they all moved here, but but you know, thank God for the old timers, right? But anyway, I wasn't really interested in doing Alcoholics Anonymous any other way than the way I was doing it. I spent the first 13 years of my sobriety doing AA that way, right? I got sober on the west side of Los Angeles, right? And I had a pattern, right? And my pattern was this. I got sober, I made a whole bunch of friends, went to a whole bunch of meetings, got a whole bunch of commitments, right? Started to make a whole bunch of decisions based on self that later placed me in a position to be hurt, right? I started to build a case about why I'm right about how wrong you are. And then I realized, you know, when you do that, if you're the problem, all I have to do is get rid of you, right? So I pulled a geographic, right? I went from one side of a mountain. All you have to do is change a mountain range. You'll never see those people ever again, right? There's so much traffic in LA. Nobody's driving anywhere to serve as a resentment, I'm just saying. So I go from all the way to the West Valley, and I started all over again, right? Made a whole bunch of friends. Right? Went to a whole bunch of meetings, got a whole bunch of commitments, right? Started to make decisions based on self that later placed her. Y'all started to talk behind my back and not like me so much, and I can't have that, right? I can't deal with that, so I got to start building a case about why I'm right about how wrong you are, and I just got to get rid of you people. It's you people in the West Valley. Y'all are, again, drama queens and gossip mongers, and, you know, we're not talking about me. We are talking about you, and I got to go. Right? So I went from the West Valley, crossed the 405 freeway, because all you got to do is, you know, cross a major thing and you'll never see those people again. And poof, now I'm in the East Valley, right? Never saw those people again. Fantastic. Problem solved, right? Now I'm in the East Valley, right? Did it one more time. This is my conflict resolution system. This is the conflict resolution system that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with, right? Now I'm in the East Valley, right? Get a whole bunch of commitments, go to a whole bunch of meetings, make a whole bunch of friends. The same thing starts again, right? But now I'm building a case not only against you guys, you know, the drama queen, the gossip mongers, blah, 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 right? But now I'm building a case against Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I've been here 13 years. 13 years. And the only thing different about my life is that I remember every horrible moment of it. Right? Every horrible, every bad idea, like I remember all of it, right? And that was the worst part, right? And so I started to build a case against Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And again, you know, you're only as good as the teachers who are put in front of you, right? And so I had said to a friend of mine, I said, I'm going to go to one more meeting. It's the last meeting I'm ever going to go to. I said, and if I don't hear something different, that's it. I'm out of here, right? So I go to this meeting, and it's a big book study, right? And the only reason I went to this big book study is because this woman, who had been my sponsor for 3 years, I think she knew, but I'm not sure, she went to this meeting, right? And I thought, well, I have to at least go say goodbye to her just in case anybody's looking for me, right? So that they know where I went. So I was going to go to the meeting, say goodbye to her. That's it. I'm out of here, right? And that was my motive for going to the meeting. And this woman, I had talked to her. She'd been my sponsor for like 3 years, maybe 4 years. The only time I ever talked to her was to call her and ask her to give me a cake. That was it. Like, that was the only time I talked to her, right? Because remember, I didn't grow up in an environment, even in Alcoholics Anonymous, where I was taught about relationships, right? I didn't know how to be a sponsee. I didn't know how to have a sponsor. I didn't know how to have relationships. Like, I take hostages for crying out loud, right? Like, my relationships involve duct tape and ties, right? Like, I don't know how to be friends with anybody, right? So I go to this meeting, and I walk in, and it's a bunch of old-timers. And I'm like, oh, God. Oh, God, this is not going to go well for me, right? And I walk in, and I sit down. There's a crusty old guy, right, sitting at the front, right, reading the big book. Oh, here we go, right? And he's reading the big book, right? He reads, like, 4-5 pages, right? And it's a sniper meeting, right, where they call on people to share. You're not allowed to raise your hand. And he was real good at spotting broken, right? And he'd be like, hey, you share. You share. You share. And then he sees me sitting over there like this. Right? And he's like, hey, you, happy pants, why don't you share? Right? And I vomit all over this meeting about how much I hate you people and I hate alcoholics. This crap doesn't work and blah, 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 blah. Right? I mean, it was the sickest share in the world, right? You have to be 13 years dry to be that crazy, right? Newcomers sounded like a dream come true compared to me in that moment, right? And at the end of this meeting, this other old-timer walked up to me and he put his hand on my arm and he said, Quincy, he said, AA is full of sick people. Do not expect them to act well. And I didn't know if he was talking about me or if he was talking about you. I was so confused, right? And so, but the thing that happened in that moment was he gave me grace in that moment. He gave me the ability to say, I don't have to know everything. I don't have to leave here either just because it hasn't worked the way I thought it was supposed to. I can start over any time I want to. And it doesn't matter. We're all just here trying to get this done. That's all we're trying to do, right? Miracle number two. Miracle number three was wearing a skirt and was scary, scary, scary. She walked up to me, and she was a crazy, scary lady, right? Because she was the kind of person whose whole deportment shouted that she had a real answer. And I don't know about you, but I'd spend my whole life staying away from people with a real answer because I didn't really want one, right? But she walked right through my force field, and she put her card in my hand, and she said, Quincy, she said, I am really good at doing column work, and if you want to get free of those resentments, I can help you. And I remember thinking, what resentments is she talking about? I don't have any resentments. What is she talking about? Right? Like, that's how delusional I was. Like, I had no awareness of myself at all, and I did not know what she was talking about, right? But something told me to call the crazy, scary lady, right? And so I did. And she said, Quincy, I just want you to write down everybody you're mad at and why you're mad at them, and then come to my house. And I said, okay. And this is usually where I put in my 30-second commercial about there is no wrong way to do Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no wrong way to do this, right? Every one of us gets to Alcoholics Anonymous with a different level of education, a different experience, a different level of understanding, a different level of pain, a different everything, right? So however we get here and how this process is the right way to get through this process. And I say that because I have been the psycho-Nazi who has stood at the front of rooms like this and said, if you're not doing AA like this, then you're not really doing it. And I got to tell you, not only is that super arrogant, right, but it kills people, right? Because I don't know about you, but I'm always afraid I'm doing something wrong. And if I think I'm doing something wrong, I'm leaving, right? I'd rather not try. I'd rather not try than do it wrong, right? So my amends for the rest of my natural-born life is to get up here and say, there's no wrong way to do this, right? Just go on your journey. Just have your journey, right? However you need to do it, just get it done, right? Stay. That's all I want you to do is stay, right? Back to my story. Okay, so when I went to her house, she busted out her big book, right? This was magical. She busted out her big book, and it was amazing because, like, butterflies didn't fly out of it, and dust and birds and all kinds of stuff, right? She opened her big book, and it was, like, covered in yellow highlighter and notes everywhere, and I was like, I'm with the queen. Like, I have landed in the queen's arsenal. And she opened her big book and she pointed out to me the column work, the way column work was explained to her, right? And, you know, we all have heard different stories about how column work should be done. It's four columns, it's five columns. I don't care if it's 100 columns, right? You, however many columns you need, rock out, right? Hers was seven columns, right? I had never done any columns, so I didn't know, right? And so she busts out her book, and she takes it through, and we start to go through the columns. And within 5 minutes of being in that woman's house, I had felt the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous and felt a level of freedom I had never felt in my entire life. Never, right? So, of course, I asked her to marry me. I mean, I asked her to sponsor me, which is kind of the same. And she said yes, and then she took me through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And when she took me through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, she took me through page for page, word for word, and helped me understand and explain how this applies to me, right? You know, when we did that inventory, I'll just go through it really quick because for me it's super powerful. But, you know, she had me do the first column was who, the second column was why, the third column was how did it affect you, right, which is probably the most misunderstood column in the whole process, right? Because I don't know about you, but I've spent my entire life ignoring my instincts. So when you ask me, how does it affect me instinctually? I have no idea. I don't even know what that means, right? And so I needed her to help me understand how instinctually I was threatened, right? Then the fourth column was, well, you know, what did you bring to the party, right? How did you respond when that happened? What did you say when that happened? What did you do to get that to happen? You know, whatever it was. And I was really good, and it talks about this in the big book. You know, looking at your part was as much as I had ever done, right? And I was really good at looking at your part. But I had never seen my part because I didn't believe I had one, right? And so when she said to me, you know, well, what did you bring to the party? I was like, well, what do you mean? She said, well, how did you react or respond when that happened? And I told her, right? And she goes, did that work? And I said, well, no, it made things worse. And she said, oh, really, right? So then the fifth column was, well, what do you wish you could have done differently? And I remember thinking, what do I wish I could have done differently? I wish I could have stabbed him in the neck. That's what I wish I could have done differently. Like, I would do inventory on my ex-husband all the time. He was my current husband at the moment. But I would be so mad at him, and she would say that. I'd be like, well, I wish I could have stabbed him in the fork with an eye. You know, a fork. And she's like, that's not what we're looking for here. She's like, we're looking for recovered behavior. I go, oh, well, that would explain why I don't have any. Right? And so I never could get that column right. I could never get that column right. What do I wish I could do different? I don't know. And she'd say, well, why don't you, you know, whatever it was, tell them how you feel. Why would I do that, right? What's that going to accomplish? Stabbing him in the neck would be just the same thing, right? She thought I was hysterical, but I could never figure that part out. So I needed a sponsor for that. And that was the first time I ever really understood what the value of having somebody who was completely objective to my life was in having them in my life, was because they could see situations that I had was in or put myself in with no emotional attachment and could be rational about the situation. I couldn't be rational about anything that was attached to me, ever, right? Because I was too emotionally attached. And then she would say, well, why didn't you do that, right? Why didn't you tell him how you felt? And I'd say, because he wouldn't listen. She, oh, no, no, no. She says, what's the fear? What are you afraid of? What are you afraid of that if you tell him how you feel, what are you afraid is going to happen, right? And I'd say, well, I'm afraid he's going to get mad. I'm afraid I'm going to hurt his feelings. I'm afraid he's not going to like me. I'm afraid he's going to leave me. I'm afraid, you know, he's not going to love me and I'm going to be alone, right? And she'd say, yeah. And she said, and those fears are what generates the defective behavior. And I was like, oh, okay. And then she'd say, so how do you behave when you're afraid you're going to hurt somebody's feelings? And I was like, I don't know, I'm a people pleaser. I'm manipulative, right? I'm dishonest. I'm controlling. I'm, you know, all kinds of crazy things, right? And that was the process that she took me through for my entire inventory, right? And it was the same questions. It was the same algebraic equation for everything, right? And when I got on the other side of that inventory, I was freer than I had ever been in my entire life. I didn't have any unresolved feelings. I didn't have any unresolved ill will. I didn't have any unresolved anything. And I had a clear understanding of who I was and what was working for me and what wasn't working for me. You know, that inventory process made it really clear that those first two columns are the only columns that you're involved in, right? That's it, because I can't do anything about that piece. There's nothing, that is the piece that I'm powerless over, right? The piece I'm not powerless over are the other five columns, right? And she showed me how to use emotional algebra in order to solve a problem every time, right? People always say, I remember being in high school saying, why do we have to do algebra? I'm never going to learn that. Why do I have to do, I'm never going to use it ever again in my entire life, right? But when I went to college, I had a math teacher who said, you know, algebra is just a formula to solve a problem, right? That's all it is. And she said, and so when I learned this way of doing column work, it's just a formula to solve a problem. And that's what the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are. They are just a formula to solve a problem. And if I apply them to every problem I have, they work every time. Not just once in a while, they work every time. You know, people in Alcoholics Anonymous have disappointed me plenty and have let me down plenty, as I have let them down, right? Many, many times, and probably will many more, right? But the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, the steps, the traditions, the concepts, those things have never disappointed me. And they have always worked. And I'm super grateful for that. She took me through the big book page for page, word for word. And I remember when I sat at her house, she said, I just want you to thumb through the big book really quick. And she said, do you see all that yellow that you put in there? All that highlighting you put in there? She said, yeah. She said, that's your personal alcoholism. She said, you never have to wonder ever again if you're an alcoholic, right? Because getting sober at 18, I've never had a legal drink in my life, right? And there's this mind bend that comes with getting sober really young that thinks, oh, maybe I wasn't really an alcoholic. Maybe it was just, you know, bad chemistry at the time. Whatever it is, right? A phase. It's just a phase, right? But what makes me an alcoholic, right, based on what the big book says, is three things, right? I have a physical allergy that when I put alcohol into my system, no matter how old I am or what kind of alcohol it is, I want more. That's always the case. That is always the case, has always been the case, will always be the case, right? That's the physical part of it, right? The mental part is that whether I'm drinking or I'm not drinking, I'm thinking about what I'm going to get or what I'm not going to get, right? I'm obsessing about where do I have to go, what do I have to do, who do I have to be to get what I need to avoid feeling how I'm feeling. Right? Because that mental obsession part goes with the spiritual malady part, which was the part that was the hardest for me to understand, which is why service work and being of service and working one alcoholic to another, sponsoring people, having a sponsor is so important. Because for me, the spiritual malady is about disconnection. Right? I get disconnected from myself, I get disconnected from you, and I'm disconnected from a power greater than me. And when I'm disconnected, I need alcohol and drugs to make that disconnection okay. Right? But when I'm sitting in a room or I'm in a room talking to you guys like I am now, I'm super connected to you. I'm in my body, I'm in my feet, I'm here, I'm looking at you, I see your eyes, and I am connected to you now. And this is how it's supposed to feel. This is how the universe wants me to feel. Right? This is how a power greater than me wants to feel, is connected to you and connected to myself. And that's horribly uncomfortable for somebody like me, right? Because then my ego shows up and says, oh, but you're not this, and you're not that, and nobody likes you, and you're not funny, and you're bigoted, and your hair's not long enough, and whatever, right? It comes up with all kinds of stupid things, right? And when all that stuff shows up, then the disconnection starts to happen. It's why prayer and meditation is so important. It's why working with other people is so important. It's why journaling is so important. It's why all of it is so important. It is such an effort to stay connected to myself, because my natural place of being is to be disconnected from me. Because if I'm disconnected from me, I don't think, I don't feel, I don't care. And I like that. Because when I care, I can get hurt. And then I have to stab you in the eye. This is Brian, right? So she took me through the big book. I asked her to be my sponsor. And she looked at me and she goes, oh, Quincy, I would love to be your sponsor. And that's always scary when somebody you ask is like super excited that you ask them. And I said, okay. And she said, because I have some requirements for sponsorship. And I remember thinking, oh, I have some requirements too. That you have no requirements, right? And I said, okay. Right, what are they? She said, well, she said, it's a requirement of my sponsorship that you call me every day for the first 30 days and then a minimum of once a week thereafter. Like, okay. Right? Like, nobody had ever asked me to do that before, and I wasn't going to fight about it. Like, okay, sure, how hard could that be, right? Ask somebody to call you every day for 30 days, see what happens. She said, I need you to go to 3 meetings a week. She said, one of those meetings needs to be go to. She goes, anything less than 3 meetings a week, you're really just a visitor to Alcoholics Anonymous. You're not a member. And she said, and I need you to be a member. I said, okay. She said, I need you to have commitments at those meetings. I said, okay. She said, I have a sponsees meeting at my house once a month. She said, we're going through the big book. She said, I'd really like it if you showed up to this sponsees meeting. And I remember thinking, oh, here we go. Right? Oh, yay. And I said, okay. Right? Because remember, I'm dying. I'm 13 years sober and I'm dying. I'm finally dying of alcoholism in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm like, okay, sure, I'll do that. Right? She said, but this next one's going to kill you. And I was like, all right, bring it on, right? Like, I'm all about death. Bring it on. She said, well, Quincy, she said, it is a requirement of my sponsorship that whenever you're in a meeting, if you are leading a meeting, speaking a meeting, secretary of a meeting, whatever it is, she said, it is a requirement of my sponsorship that you wear a skirt or a dress. And in my defiant little alcoholic head, I remember hearing it say, where does it say that in the big book? Right? As I'm sure some of your heads did just now, right? But today I know where it says that, right? It says it at the end of the ninth step, where it says, remember, we agreed at the beginning to go to any lengths to stay sober, right? And if that was the length I had to go to, was I willing to be inconvenienced for Alcoholics Anonymous and for my recovery? Now I know every man in this room is wondering, do I have to wear a dress to recover? I think you know the answer. Yes. At least once. With heels, I'm just saying. And hose, right? No, because it's not about the dress, right? It has nothing to do with the dress. It has everything to do with being willing to be inconvenienced. Because I don't know about you, but if I'm only doing what I want to do, I just grow in selfishness, self-pity, and disease. That's all that happens. But when I'm willing to be, let's be really clear, okay? 270 miles is not convenient. It's not about 270 miles to come hear myself talk to you for an hour. There's nothing convenient about that, right? Nothing. I shaved my legs for you people. shaved my legs. I have makeup on and a dress, for crying out loud. I didn't just fall out of bed this way, right? Like, this was an extravaganza that had to happen, right? And it's funny, because when I think about how ridiculous that sounds, right, because it does sound ridiculous, but when I think about how ridiculous that sounds, you have to remember, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous as a tomboy. I didn't wear makeup, I wore hair on top of my head, I had tore-up jeans on, flip-flops, and a sweatshirt. And every other word was the F word. That's who I was, and that's who I was up until I was 13 years sober. And when Linda finally got a hold of me, and she put these boundaries in my life, it forced me to be respectful. It forced me to grow up. It forced me to mature. It forced me to be considerate of how I affect other people, which had never happened in my entire life, because I'm selfish. And all I think about is what I want, what I need, and what I'm going to get out of you, right? And I don't care. But the truth of the matter is that the more willing I am to be inconvenienced, the bigger my spiritual program grows, right? The bigger my recovery gets, the bigger my network of people gets, right? I have an amazing life because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have an amazing life. And it's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, right? It's taken a long time just to be, it's taken 35 years just to be 35 years sober. It's amazing how that works, right? And there have not always been great times. And I've had to reinvent myself many times in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have had to, I interviewed on a podcast today called Unscripted Pivots. And I thought about, you know, we were talking about pivots. How many times have you had to reinvent who you are? I can't even count that high, right? I can't even count how many times I've had to reformulate who I am and what things mean to me. And where do I want to go? You know, when COVID happened, I was in the middle of a nervous breakdown and probably didn't even know it, right? And then the whole world shut down and said, stay home. Okay, right? Don't send an alcoholic home. Like, my mom used to say that. She's like, oh, I'd send you to your room, you'd stay there for days. She said there was never a punishment. It's not for me. Like, I would stay home for the rest of my life and never leave if I didn't have to, right? But what happens when I'm in that place is that I start to isolate and I start to build cases about why I don't need to go to meetings and why being on Zoom is enough and why I don't want to sponsor anybody and why I don't need to drive 270 miles to Fresno to speak at a meeting. You know what I mean? Like, I all of a sudden come up with all kinds of things, right? But when I'm out there doing the things that inconvenience me for my recovery, I get to remember that my life is what it is because I've done that. Because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of the people that I get to show up for, because of the people who count on me to be there, even when I don't know that they're counting on me, right? I mean, how many of you remember in the early days when you would go to meetings and the old timers would sit in the same seat, right? Do not screw with an alcoholic seat, I'm just saying, okay? That will get you murdered in Alcoholics Anonymous, but the old timers would sit in the same seat every day, every time you saw them at the meeting, right? And he'd always be like, or they'd share. Every one of them would share at every meeting, right? They would start the meeting and they'd end the meeting, whatever it was. Like, what the hell? And you as a newcomer is like, well, I have something to say. It's like, no, you don't. But you started to count on the old timers sitting in the space that they were sitting in. Like, I knew that when I walked in the meeting on Thursday nights at the Big Book Study, Jim would be sitting in that chair, Ray would be sitting in that chair, and Linda'd be sitting right there. And they were there every week for 18 years. For 18 years, they were in those seats. And even at 13 years of sobriety, that was important because it meant they were being inconvenienced. And they would drive from Palm Springs. Linda and Ray would drive from Palm Springs every week after they moved out of the valley to come back to service that meeting because people counted on them. And you know what? Today, I'm that person. I'm that person who sits in that meeting on Wednesday night. I'm the person who sits in that meeting on Thursday night that the newcomers are saying, well, Quincy's here. I have no excuses. Quincy drove an hour and 15 minutes to get to this meeting. I have no reason not to cross the street and go to a meeting, right? So, you know, those are the things that are important to us, right? And those are the things that happen as a result of you know, being around here for a really long time. You know, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I want to welcome you to the greatest experience of your entire life, you know? I'll share this story. You know, Linda, I used to have to call Linda every day, right, for the first 30 days, and then once a week. And we've all been this sponsee, right? And if you say weren't, you're a liar. But we've all been the sponsee, where we call our sponsor and go, so this is what's going on, and this is what's happening. I'm just checking in. And da-da-da-da-da. And they would, you know, we dump all of our crap that nobody cares about, but onto their machine or onto them, whatever it is. We've all been the sponsee. Blah-bitty-blah, this is what's going on, this is what's happening. And so I would the sponsors. I would call her and say, so this is what's happening, and this is how it's going, and this is what's going. And she'd go, okay, bye. And she'd hang up on me. I was like, what would just happen? Like, I was stunned. The first time it happened, I literally, like, my mouth fell open. And I was like, oh, she must be just having a bad day, right? I'll just call her tomorrow, see what happens again, right? So I call her the next day. Hi, it's me. I'm just checking in. Blah, blah, blah. What's going on? Da, 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 da. She's like, okay, bye. And she hung up on me again. I was like, oh, no. We have problems. Oh, no. I have a problem with my sponsor. How do you deal with a problem with your sponsor who's supposed to teach you how to deal with problems with other people who hasn't taught me how to do that yet, right? I don't know what to do, right? So, of course, I started doing what I always do. I start to build a case about why she's bananas, right? And then I get all my sober sisters on the bandwagon. Oh, yeah, she's crazy. I don't know. I don't know what you want to do with that. And finally, one of them said, why don't you just call her and ask her if she doesn't like you? I'm all, she says, no, I don't like you. What do I do then? She goes, Quincy, she's not going to say that. I go, you don't know that. She goes, just call her and ask her. Fine. Hey, Linda, it's Quincy. So I have a question, kind of, sort of. She's like, sure. She said, I go, do you not like me? She goes, oh, no, Quincy, I like you just fine. She said, but when you call, you have conversations at me, not with me. She said, let's be really clear. I didn't ask you to sponsor me. I don't want what you have. I don't want what you have. And she said, how do you think you're going to get what I have by calling and talking at me? I was like, oh, okay. So how do we fix that? She said, well, you need to call, and you need to ask a question. Every time you call, you need to call and ask a question. She said, because if you're asking a question, she said, that's how you're going to get my information, right? She said, that's how you're going to, you know, learn how to be open-minded, she said, which is truly a third step. Like, if you really want to learn how to do this different, you got to ask questions. And she said, and then we can have a conversation. I said, okay. I said, but I don't really have any questions. She said, make them up. I don't care. Right? I was like, oh, okay, fine. Right? So we get off the phone. I didn't call her for 3 weeks. And she calls me and she goes, I thought we were clear on how this was going to go. Right? I said, well, I couldn't come up with a question. She goes, oh, my God, Quincy. She said, there's a different question on every page of the big book. She said, just pull one out. Who cares? She said, ask me a question you think you already have the answer to. Those are the best. Hey, so I didn't want to ask you. Oh, yeah, because I'm not growing or changing at all, right? And I said, I just don't know how to do that. She said, Quincy, you got to do it. It's the only thing that's going to save your life. And she was right. And when I learned how to ask questions in this program and I learned how to be willing to listen to how somebody else does something, my life changed exponentially, right? And so now when my sponsees do that to me, I do what she did to me. Okay, bye. And they've heard me speak enough times that they know what that means. Yeah, you're having a conversation at me, and I don't have time for that, right? She was a magical woman, and she taught me so many things in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she taught me these three really, really important things, which I will leave you with. She said, Quincy, she said, you are responsible for your happiness. She said, nobody has the power to make you unhappy except you. And she said, so if something's bothering you, if you're resentful, if you're not okay, whatever it is, you're mad, she said, get in here, let's do the column work so you can get back to happy, joyous, and free. She said, because at the end of the day, your happiness is your responsibility. And if you're letting somebody else have that kind of power over you, you're giving it to them. And I was like, that's good news and bad news, right? Good news is I can be happy whenever I want to. Bad news is I have to do the work, and I don't really want to. She said, the second thing is, she said, you're responsible for your recovery. She said, I may be your sponsor. She said, but if you want what I have, you better chase me like I owe you money. Right? She said, because, again, I don't want what you have. If you want what I have, you better come find it. Right? And so I did. I called her. I learned how to ask questions. I went to hear her speak all the time. I went to the meetings she went to. I showed up at the convention she wanted me at. We did all the crazy things that she told me to do. And I have to tell you, my life is better as a result of it. Right? And I'm forever grateful for that. And she said, Quincy, the last thing is she said, you are responsible for carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, this is not the Quincy show. She said, nobody cares how many dogs you have, what you do for a living, what your children look like. Nobody cares. All anybody really wants to hear about is whether or not you have worked these steps, they have changed your life, and that you live a life that you're happy about. She said, that's all anybody wants to know. And she said, and that's your job. So hopefully, that's what I just did. Thank you.